Welcome to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. It's great to have you back. Great if you're joining us for the first time. This is a show where we talk about all things love, how to love and be loved, and how to develop those capacities and loving relationships. We're very fortunate today to have as our guest Harriet Tinka, who hails from Canada. Welcome to our show, Harriet.
Oh, thank you. I'm really excited to be here and talking to you and the audience. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, you bet. I can just give you a quick story about myself. So my name is Harriet Tinka, as you said, and I guess I have a lot of things that I do here in Canada. Where am I? I always never know where to begin. So basically, I work with young women as well as young men on how to love themselves unconditionally. And the reason that I'm so passionate about that is a few years back, and I'll share my story as well shortly, but I was in a situation where I was an international model. My whole career was on top of the game, and all the little girls wanted the life that I had until I went through a domestic violence situation. And there I went through so much. I got traumatized. I went through the, hating and not loving yourself completely. But I got through it. And now what I do is share with my audience how to love themselves unconditionally. And it's not about what happened to you. It's what you do with what happens. And what I want to do is share with the world as much as I can what I can do to help them so that they can go through, get through what they're going through and just have a much better life, the life they were meant to have.
Oh, well, tell us a little bit more about your story.
Oh, you bet. And I'm definitely happy to share my story. And even today, it's still surreal for me to believe that I'm a domestic violence survivor. Here I was, an international model, walking the runways, and I was so full of confidence, yet I was a victim of a stalker. So my story really begins when I just retired from the modeling industry. I decided to just stay away from the industry because I had done what I needed to do and just focus on my formal education. So it was at the university that I was befriended by a fellow student, having absolutely no idea that his attraction to me was like a psychological trap that was disguised as love that later on would end up being deadly. And I was your typical naive, a victim of domestic violence. I was young. I didn't know any signs of an abusive relationship. But yet I was vulnerable enough to trust him. So as I got to know him, I noticed he was very kind, but then he would always have these moments where he was very abusive. He would scream and yell and hit me, but then he would apologize later on. So I thought, oh, he apologized. Oh, life is good. So I carried on with the relationship. But it got to a point where it was just so abusive and I was so afraid for my life that I decided to go to the police and share with them my fear. But they said there's absolutely nothing they could do. The only thing that they could do is really give me a restraining order against him. So I said, well, if that's all you can offer me, I'll take it. And the reason they said that is because nothing had happened. It was his word against mine. So I took the restraining order and I thought, nothing's going to happen. He's going to stay away from me. And things went on very well until one night I was at the university studying, getting ready for my project that was due within days. So I looked at the time and I realized, oh my, I'm spending way too long at the university. Better go home and rest. So I got out, started walking towards my apartment building, and I wasn't really paying attention to my surrounding. I was just focused on getting home and going to bed. So walking to the elevator, looking inside my bag, trying to find my keys so that I would be ready as soon as I get out the elevator. And all of a sudden, somebody strangled my neck so tight and said, how dare you get that restraining order against me? Don't you know that I'm the only man who ever loved you? And I tried to scream, but he took his socks off and stuffed it into my mouth and to silence me. Then he grabbed me out of the elevator, took me off, and drove off as far as we could go. And as we're driving, he noticed a telephone booth. And neither one of us had a cell phone. And he asked me to go out there, call my parents, and say goodbye to them, because this would be the last time that I would ever hear from them. And I looked at him, I said, no. And he he was very angry that I said no to him. So I said, Harriet, I'm going to ask you one more time. You need to get out of this car and go out there and call your parents, because in the back of my car, I have a knife, a rope, and gasoline. And if you do not do what I'm saying, I'm going to kill you. And I said, I looked at him directly, and I said, no. So he got so angry at the fact that I said no for the second time. So he grabbed, he reached over the glove compartment, took out a knife, and he stabbed me two times on my left leg. And there was blood gushing everywhere. Now, even today, I have absolutely no idea how I got from that point in the vehicle to the hospital. So when I woke up, I looked around, and there was my father, the police, and the doctor. And the doctor told me that I had lost so much blood, chances of me ever walking again was slim to none. So when I heard the doctor say this, I was in shock. I could not believe that not too long ago I was on the runway, walking on the runway, having so much confidence, and yet here I was, a cripple and depressed. So the only thing that separated the depression and confidence was my trauma. So I started feeling sorry for myself, saying, why me? How could this happen? What is my life? Does it matter? There's just so many thoughts going through my mind. And I said to myself, how I'm never going to walk again. So it was a lot of internal dialogue that I went through. And I realized later on I needed to start working on myself. So I took the doctor's suggestion where he said I needed to start getting physiotherapy, which is rehab, I guess. And I said, well, I have nothing to lose. I'll just try to learn how to walk all over again. So one afternoon I was in the hospital. A little girl came in on a wheelchair, full of energy, and I didn't really want to talk to her. And she looked at me. She wanted to know why I was in the hospital sitting there with crutches. And I didn't really want to talk to her, but eventually I was forced to. And I told her my story, and she looked at me with her big green eyes, and she said, wow, you really should share your story with the world. And I looked at this little girl, and I thought, a nine-year-old, where did she get this wisdom? She's 9 years old, and she's on a wheelchair. So I asked her what her story was. She looked at me and said, not too long ago, she was busy getting ready to go for a dance, and she was driving with her parents to a ballet recital. And all of a sudden, there was a head-on collision. The drunk driver hit their vehicle. Both her parents died. She survived. So she was now motherless, fatherless, and homeless. Yet she had so much gratitude. And I asked her why she had so much gratitude. She said that in her family, she learned to appreciate the little things in life. And she said she was lucky that she was alive. So when I heard her story, I thought, oh my goodness, my story is nothing compared to hers. But really, life is not about comparing stories at all. Life is really about what you do with what happens. So it took me a long time to go back and remember what the little girl said, because life is about connecting the dots from the back. So later on, when I started getting better and healing, that I realized I really should listen to what her message was. So that's when I started making a difference in the world. So now I share my story with anybody going through trauma to share how I got through it, because it wasn't an overnight success. I had to really, really work with myself. So that's what I do to share that with the world.
So share with us a little bit, Harriet, how you healed. Well, tell us about the healing process.
It wasn't easy, definitely, because one of the things that when I was going through this, the number one thing was forgiveness. And that was the toughest thing to go through. So when something like that happens to you, it's really, really hard to forgive. And forgiveness is not unnatural. We're not born with the ability to forgive. We're born with the ability to hate. So hate is a natural human emotion. And when you look in the Wikipedia, hate is really, the definition is an intense or passionate dislike for someone. And when people say hate, it's really what they mean is, I don't want to be angry, because anger is reactive, it's hostile, it's destructive. But hate is really, we use hate because it reminds us of what we love. For example, I can say, I hate cancer because I hate to see my father dying and suffering. So for me, I used 3 steps to learn how to forgive. Number one, I had to write down the reason why I was feeling the way I was feeling. So the reason why you hate. I hate my attacker because he put me in the hospital. I hate my attacker because he put a scar my leg. That was step number one. Number two, take the second sentence and turn it into love. I hate my attacker because I love being healthy. I hate my attacker because I love my perfect imperfection. And then number three, focus on the love statement and forget about the hate. I love being healthy. I love my perfect imperfection. I love my family support. So you can use, so you own it. Number one, write down the reason you feel the way you do. And the second, take the second sentence and turn it into love. And then number three, focus on the love statement. So you do it in the morning and afternoon. So I hope you use these three steps just to help me forgive and learn how to forgive so that I can continue loving myself unconditionally.
So did you do that in a meditative way, Harriet, those three steps, twice a day, where you contemplated and went through those in sort of a meditative way? Is that what it was like for you?
For me, initially, meditation wasn't easy for me because I wasn't a meditating type. So what I did for me was write it in a gratitude journal initially because it was hard for me to meditate because I've never been a meditating type because I didn't really understand how it all worked. So I started off writing it down, and it was later on that I found meditation was really soothing and calming because you're focusing on yourself, you know, focusing about the external noise. It's just about you and clearing all the negative energy out of you.
And how long did it take for this practice before you noticed an easing of the hatred?
Well, it actually took a while for me. It took almost, I started seeing results about 3 months. I started to see, oh, you know what? I am owning this. I'm not blaming the person that did it to me. In fact, I've forgiven him completely, and I wish so much that one day I'll meet him and let him know that I've forgiven him. Because the hate and all that, it doesn't help you in any way at all. It happened to you for a reason. Things happen to you for a reason. And they come, at the time you don't see it, but there's some lessons within you that are there. And you start off with love. Number one is love is the most important thing that you have to do before anything. Because if you love yourself unconditionally, everything else is extra.
Oh, that's so wise and so true. What happened to your attacker?
He was given about, I think it was in total a month. It was really nothing. Because that was almost also a kick in the butt. But in a lot of ways, I felt he really, he had a low self-esteem. And this was his way of really reacting. He didn't know how to react. He was an only child. And I'm not trying to make excuses for him, but I know he needed help. And I hope that he did get the help that he needed so he doesn't do this to somebody else, maybe somebody who's not as strong as I was emotionally.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I really admire you and your capacity for forgiveness and for compassion for this person who hurt you so badly. It's extraordinary. I'm wondering how you came to be the way you are. Did you learn this from your parents, or how do you understand how you developed such a capacity for compassion, Harriet?
I think it all boils down to your child and how you were raised. And I was born in Kenya, and in Kenya, in my country, I think one of the biggest things that we grow up with is the family support. It's basically the whole entire community raises you. Like, say, in my country, if I was doing something wrong, another parent could come and discipline me. So that's kind of the culture we grew up with. Love everybody unconditionally. Everybody is important. It doesn't matter if one person is got more money than the other person. A person is a person, and they should be treated accordingly. And it didn't matter what race or anything. Everybody is treated very well, and you should love yourself. And if something happens to you, there's a reason. Learn from it and take the lesson from everything, from failure, from success, from everything, all the challenges. So I think it was already instilled in me to begin with, so I came up with a strong foundation.
Oh, that's wonderful. You're very blessed in that way. That's just wonderful. And then you moved to Canada at some point. Is that right? Or?
Yes, we moved here when I was quite young at the time. It was in high school. And it was a culture shock coming here, and a lot of the things that happened in Canada was so different from Kenya. Like opening the doors, we open them differently. Everything is different. We were expected to wear regular clothing instead of uniform in school, and then you call your teacher by their first name. I thought that was a little bit disrespectful. It's always by Mr. or Mrs. or Miss. But in Canada, you had to call them by the first name. So I thought that was a little bit informal. So there was a lot of culture shock. But I adjusted accordingly. But I still have that instilled in me.
Oh, that's just, oh, boy. Wow. So tell us, you have a company called Empowered Me. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you do now?
Oh, you betcha. So Empowered Me is about empowering young people to be the truest version of themselves. And I developed the company because when I was doing international work, I met an accountant who really inspired me. So I got my designation. So I am an accountant as well. So I have that business background as well to be an entrepreneur. So I know what it takes to be an entrepreneur. But in addition to that, my program was actually recognized by my co-author, Dr. Laika. He was doing an award because Dr. Laika is a philanthropist. So during the award, when I won the award under the Turning Point category, I met with him. And we had a conversation, and we said perhaps one day we'll write a book, and that's the book that we wrote, Living a Fantastic, Secrets of Living a Fantastic Life. So during the award, I was recognized for the things that I do in the community, like working with young girls, mostly I really focus on the young girls because I find that the girls have such a low self-esteem. But if I'm going to empower the girls, I also have to work with boys. So I do work with boys and men and women in any sort of situation, because you don't just want to focus on one area. If you can empower as many people, why not do it? And that's what I focus on. So my program has 12 modules, very similar to what you were talking about in your book. So each, like self-esteem, communication, time management, setting your goals, overcoming obstacles, living with poverty. So all of those I work with my students and anybody in the program, and I empower them to be the best version of themselves.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Wow. Do you have any particular stories of people you've worked with that you think would be inspiring for our listeners?
Oh, you bet. I think one of the biggest things that I find with a lot of people is when they've gone through so much, they lose their self-worth. They feel that they're not good enough. So what I do, I know they all come in and they'll be feeling down in the dumps. So what I do is I usually bring a $20 bill, and I ask them, who wants this $20 bill? Everybody puts up their hand. And I say, okay. So I take the $20 bill, I crumple it up, and I step on it. Sometimes I dump some water. And then I ask them, who wants this $20 bill? And everybody puts up their hand. And I ask them why. And they say, because it does not lose its self-worth. It's worth. It's still $20. So I say, this is the same thing for all of you. In life, you're going to be crumbled. You're going to be squished. People are going to dump water on you. All sorts of things are going to happen to you. But at the end of the day, you do not lose your self-worth. You're still somebody special. So everything I use in the program is all tangible, it's visual, because everybody wants to see what it is that I'm talking about. Even when it comes to self-esteem, I will visualize, I'll show them what is self-esteem. So with self-esteem, I'll use a treasure box, an empty treasure box, and they say, this is what your self-esteem looks like when you're born. There's nothing going on. And time goes on, people say positive and empowering things, so things start going into your treasure box. But when people are mean and negative, things start coming out of your treasure box. You come out. And sometimes you get to a point where it's so negative that you seal your treasure box and nothing's going in. So when nothing goes in, that's when you have low self-esteem. So I give them tools on how to open up that treasure box so that things can start going on into your treasure box so you can start feeling great about themselves. So I give them the three different tools, things like belonging, that sense of belonging when you're around people who love you and support you. You have that sense of belonging when you accomplish. Number two is that sense of appreciation. When you do something for somebody and they say thank you, you feel good because of that sense of appreciation. And the third is that sense of accomplishment. When you do something and you didn't think you can do it and all of a sudden you can do it, voila, you feel good. So those are kind of like the three tools, the components of self-esteem that I'll share with them, that sense of belonging, sense of appreciation, and accomplishment. So once, and I go into details with each one, give them examples that they can really relate to so that they can see, okay, my self-esteem box is closed. How can I open it? Sense of belonging, accomplishment, and appreciation. And at the end of the day, all those three will not work if there's no gratitude. So I encourage them to have a gratitude journal, because without gratitude, you really don't know what good things you have. You just take everything for granted. So I go through a lot of details with them to make sure that they really are getting it. It's instilling in them so that they can feel that they matter, because it's so, so important.
It's so important to feel that we matter. You're blending a couple of concepts here, Harriet, which I think is good. One is the idea of self-love or self-worth and self-esteem. And some people, some writers, differentiate between those. And in one way, you're saying we're all like crumpled $20 bills, that we all have the same essential self-worth or value. But self-esteem is related, as you said, to that sense of belonging, being appreciated, and what we've accomplished. And it's interesting to think about how self-esteem and self-worth can sort of live right beside each other.
Well, you bet. They're all so very integrated. So when I teach them, I almost use that Maslow hierarchy of needs to start off with self-awareness, then self-acceptance, self-love, self-respect, and then self-worth. At the end of the day, when all those kind of come together, you are empowered and you have that emotional intelligence, because emotional intelligence, how you manage your stress, your challenges, and all of those are all intertwined into self-esteem. So self-esteem is almost like the mother of all of those things. Self-awareness is part of self-esteem. So they all work together.
Oh, that's nice. Nicely put. Well, listen, we're going to take a little bit of a break. Are you listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike and our guest, Harriet Tinka? And we will be right back after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee, your host here, with our guest, Harriet Tinka, who hails from Canada. And welcome back, Harriet.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, we were talking during the break, Harriet, about sort of your approach to really, I can hear that you're just pouring your love forth onto the people that you work with, and through your love, they're helping them to cultivate their love. And you were talking a little bit, you mentioned the word, the golden pearls. Can you say a little bit more about what that is?
Oh, you bet. So the book that me and Dr. Leica put together, we had 13 golden pearls within. And the golden pearls actually do exist in real life. And the way the golden pearl is formed is it can be found in a specific oyster, and that's a South Sea oyster that you can, I know it's from Indonesia and the Philippines. So the way it works, a little sand goes into the oyster, and the oyster starts to wash it off, try to push it out with a little material, a luster, and it produces a beautiful golden pearl. So this trauma and pain that goes through the oyster, it comes out as a golden pearl. So that was symbolic to the life that we both went through, which was the suffering that we went through really came out to be a beautiful thing. So same thing as a golden pearl, the trauma that it goes through to become a golden pearl. It became a beautiful golden pearl. And one golden pearl actually was about $10,000. So it's very, very rare. So that's why I found that the golden pearl was very symbolic to what I went through as well. And now I come out to be a beautiful person and sharing all my messages with the world. So I'm so excited about having to share that with the world after the trauma I went through. So I use my trauma to share with the world my wisdom.
You know, I just love that metaphor, Harriet, about a pearl sort of walling off the trauma and creating something beautiful. And, you know, there's this phenomenon in psychiatry that you probably heard of called post-traumatic growth. And the idea being that nobody wishes to endure trauma or hardship. But if we are, and in some ways we are all wounded by the world to varying degrees, we all suffer. From wounds or trauma of some degree, but what you're saying is such a message of hope that our trauma, if we can heal from it properly, can really be a source of incredible growth of wisdom and compassion.
You bet, yeah, because we go through, sometimes we don't like it, but it's when we go through pain and all the trauma that we really, that's when we grow. But when things are going well, we just you know, it's basically business as usual, nothing here. But when you go into pain, that's when you're fighting. That's when you really want to move to the next level so that you can be a better person. So trauma really reminds us, and pain also does remind us to really, what is the lesson that we're learning from it? There's always something that we all have to go through to move on to the next level. And the acronym for pain is pay attention inside. So that's what pain stands for. Pay attention inside.
Oh, I love that.
Pay attention inside. Don't ignore yourself. Pay attention inside.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to steal that. Do you mind?
Oh, of course, yes.
Okay.
Yes, do it.
I love
it. It's all about, you know, sharing and making everybody, because that's why I like to just use acronyms or use things like that, because people remember better when you do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so true. We live in such a pain-phobic society where pain is really seen as something bad, and really, it's like our we've been programmed that we should do everything we can to avoid our pain. So use drugs, use alcohol, use distraction, numb and avoid as much as we can, withdrawal, retreat, don't encounter situations that may be anxiety provoking or painful. And so I really love your message of really attending to our pain rather than trying to avoid our pain. That really is the pathway to healing, don't you think?
It is, or definitely it is. We really need to embrace it, even though it's so uncomfortable. Because the body and all of us, we always want to go to the familiar, because familiar is what we're comfortable with. But we need to get uncomfortable so we can be comfortable and be better, because that's how we learn and that's how we grow.
Yeah, they have the saying that people will do what is familiar to them rather than what is good for them in general. And and really growth is about doing what's uncomfortable and unfamiliar sometimes to be able to heal. I know that you have, this is such an important message, and I really appreciate you for reframing pain and the way that we face pain. You've developed 13 golden pearls, it sounds like, in your book. And can you tell us about what you feel are the most important of those pearls for people to know about as they heal from their trauma?
Oh, you bet. I think there's so many. So I'll just pick one for now. One that I feel, especially now having COVID and people are really not quite sure what to do with their lives. They begin to question, what is my purpose? What can I do? You know, things are changing. What can I do? So in the book, we use a concept called Ikigai. And Ikigai is a Japanese word meaning the reason for being. So that's what the Japanese use to describe the word purpose. And Dolly Parton,
can you spell that word for, Harry, can you spell
Ikigai,
that word for our audience?
You bet. It's I-K-I-G-A-I. So it's pronounced Ikigai. But you can pronounce it however you want. But
okay.
It's pronounced Ikigai.
A reason for being, right?
Yeah, it's a Japanese word for reason for being. And when you're trying to figure out your reason for being, you have to ask yourself four very important questions. And Dolly Parton actually said it beautifully. Everybody has a purpose. So when you're trying to figure out your purpose, the reason for being, you have to ask yourself four very important questions. So number one, what do you love to do? Maybe you enjoy the art gallery, and maybe you enjoy soccer. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you want to be an artist or be something, or a soccer player. The reason maybe you like art gallery is maybe you want a career that is got that creativity in it. And maybe you enjoy soccer because you like the team focus type of career, you know, winning, that sort of thing. So maybe that's the career that you are interested in. So what is it that you love to do? And number two, what are you good at? Maybe you're good with numbers like me. I'm an accountant. Or maybe you're good like yourself, Dr. Michael. You're a very good listener. Maybe somebody who is very good at listening to people can be a psychologist or be a social worker. And sometimes you don't know what you're good at. The best thing is to ask your friends, because maybe you may have done something that nobody else is good at. It basically be like, oh, yeah, ask Dr. Michael. He's very good at putting people together, that sort of thing. So it's like, oh, I didn't know I was good at that, because you do it naturally. So ask your friend what you're good at. And then number three, what does the community need? Now, you can look around right now and look in your community. What is that gap that's missing? that you can fill in? So that's number three, what does the community need? And then the very last one is, what can you do and get paid for it? Because it's good to be compensated for what you're good at. So those are the four questions you want to ask of yourself when you're trying to figure out what your ikigai is. What is it that you love to do? What are you good at? What does the community need? And what can you do and get paid for it? So once you find your ikigai, you will really find your reason for being. And for your audiences, what I would really recommend right now is do what I call a part-time ikigai, where you write down what you're good at and what you love to do. So those are really, they're comprehensive, but they're the kind of questions that you can just do right now and just start writing a list of things. I'm good at this, I love to do this. And what's interesting is that if you ask little children, they will write down 20 things that they're really good at. But adults, we seem to have trouble. We have trouble writing down what we're good at. It's a really good practice for everyone to start writing things they're good at and start to get to know yourself again. Things that you used to love in high school. Maybe you still love them, but you forgot about it. Bring some joy in yourself. Put some music in you.
Oh, this is just so wonderful. And the part, the love part about this, Harriet, that I really like is sort of, what does the community need? You want to be, you want to do something where there's, if you will, a need or a demand, or where in some ways you're contributing or serving or giving to the world. And love is so much more than just relationships. Love is everything, right? It's about everything we're doing and how we're contributing to this incredible world that we all share together. Thank you for that wisdom on purpose. That's very, very helpful. Well, let's take another. This has gone quickly. Let's take another little short break here, and then we'll return. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Michael McGee here, your host, with Harriet Tinka, and we'll be back right after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Michael McGee, your host, with our guest Harriet Tinka. Harriet, welcome back. We were talking at the break a little bit about some of your other golden pearls, and you had mentioned attitude, which I find very important and intriguing. Can you say a little bit more about attitude?
Oh, you bet. Attitude is a really, really big one. I find it's a very comprehensive one because to understand attitude, you have to understand the diseases of attitude. What causes attitude? So there's many that have been identified in the past that I've studied. There's, of course, that we talked about earlier was self-doubt. That's part of attitude. There's complaining. Some of us like to complain because that also is another one that's under attitude. There's indifference, there's indecision, being over-cautious and pessimism. But when I talk about attitude, I think one of the ones that I think is really, I think, consumes a lot of people is worrying. Worrying is another disease of attitude. So when we, especially now with our COVID going on, we worry so much. But when you look at it in detail, what we worry about is really, that study was done actually, and here's what they came up with. Some of the things we worry about, we shouldn't worry about. So 40% of the time, we worry about things that will never happen. For example, you may say, oh, if I go to California, I'm going to get caught in that fire. Chances are that will not happen. So that's 40% is things that will not happen. And then there's 30% we worry about things that we cannot change. For example, you may have typed an email and you send it off, reply all, and you didn't really mean to do that. It's like, ooh, oops. But there's nothing you can do about it. It's done. So that is 30% of things we cannot change. And then we worry about, we wake up in the morning and you see this a rash on your skin and you're like, you go on Google, of course, because Google knows everything, and Google tells you you have a skin disease, you have cancer. So now you're going to worry about it because Google told you you're going to have that. So that's 12% we worry about these medical diagnoses that we read about. And then there's petty worries. You're thinking, oh, my goodness, I got to go home. Walmart or a grocery store is going to close by 8 o'clock. I might not get there on time. Now you're worried about it. So that's 10%. So when you do the math, 40% is things will never happen, 30% things you can't change, 12% is medical things that already happened that you diagnose yourself, 10% is petty things. So at the end of the day, 8% are the worries that you need to be concerned with. So that's legit. So your attitude is, I'm going to keep worrying. And that's doing you absolutely no good. You just, when you change the way you look at things, things change. And that's all part of attitude. And I could go on about attitude because there's so many things that I could cover under
please
that.
Please do. Tell us your thoughts about attitude. This is wonderful.
Mm-hmm. I tell you more?
Yes, please.
Yeah, okay, sure. So there's complaining. So that's another one. That's a big one. People like to complain. So this is, you're basically rewiring yourself to negativity. So you start saying you feel life is unfair because you worked so hard and you didn't get the job. And, you know, well, that person didn't deserve the job. You shouldn't have gotten the job. So now you start to complain. You consume yourself. You have this bad performance because now you're upset because somebody else got the job and you didn't. Now you're complaining. Now, there's many reasons to complain, but the biggest thing is, how do you stop complaining? I often offer three really important key things to stop complaining. Number one, gratitude. Put things in perspective. Like, just change your attitude on how you see things. And right, be grateful for the little things you have. Be grateful for your health. Be grateful for the four walls around you that are protecting you from going outside and getting into a situation maybe you could be sick outside or not be warm in a house. So be grateful for your house. Number two, what I say is, because sometimes we complain so much, especially people who may have a low self-esteem or always have that negative, I'm ugly, I'm stupid, I'm fat, all of those negativity. So to prevent that, what I've done, because if you're not aware of yourself complaining, you continue to complain. So what I recommend is wear an elastic around your wrist. And every time you complain, you say three things that are positive. So this, after a while, let's say you complain, oh, I'm so dumb, as an example. Now you have to say three things about yourself that are positive. I am ambitious. I am a good father or a good mother. I'm a good friend. So every time you say it, you snap. And I actually did this experiment with a few students in my class who were constantly complaining. And they told me after a few weeks, they realized isn't working. But it doesn't work with people with self-harm. And I had a student who was self-harming because this pain didn't help. So what I did is I told her, go to Dollarama and get those hair ties. So every time you complain, put one on your hand and see how many times you complained. She had about 120 wristbands on her hand. So that's how many times in a day she was complaining. But she had no idea she was complaining. So if you're not aware of how much you're complaining, it becomes second nature to you. So after a while, she was aware of what she was doing. At the end of maybe 3 or 4 months, it was only like 10 wristbands. And then after a while, it was 3 or 4. So it's reasonable to complain. You can't be perfect. It's okay to complain maybe 5 or 4 times, but not 120 times a day. So that's the other thing. Use an elastic to stop you from complaining. And maybe if you're the type of person who complains, create a complaint zone. Maybe go use your kitchen table to sit down and say, for this next hour, I'm going to just focus on complaining. Get it all out. Complain. You're done. You will not complain again until maybe Monday at 6 o'clock. That will be your complain moment. Just get it all out and you're done. Because that will kind of teach you how to stop complaining. Because if you're not aware, you'll keep on going. And it works beautifully. Then you realize, you know, complaining does me no good. It's a waste of my time. I need to focus on things that are more empowering, that are going to really move me to the next level. So that's also part of attitude. Change your attitude on how you complain. Don't complain. It does you no good. Focus on moving on to the next level and loving yourself because you're a beautiful person. Why waste your time complaining? Mm-mm, it's not good.
You know, Harriet, this is wonderful. I just want to share that when I think of attitude, and in my own writing and work, I really focus on this idea of, and I want to get your thoughts on this if I could, the idea of appreciation, and two components to appreciation. One that you just mentioned here, which is rather than complaining, having an attitude of non-judgment, sort of a humble attitude of just not complaining about the way things are. Because when you complain, in my mind, you're kind of picking a fight with reality in which you're never going to win.
That's right, exactly. Just let it go.
So that idea of appreciation, I don't know, what are your thoughts about appreciation in terms of an attitude?
I think what you're saying is actually those are the tools of making your your attitude better. Because when you're, for example, if you're complaining, that's the problem there. It's an attitude disease right there. Complaining is an attitude disease. But what you're offering about gratitude, that's the tool you use to stop complaining. Definitely, we're talking about the same thing. We just package them a little bit differently. Because if you have if your self-doubt is a disease, what is the tool that is going to help you get over that attitude disease? And complaining is a disease.
Yeah.
What you're doing, you're offering tools of the disease.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Harriet, you are a wise and beautiful being and have so much to share with the world. Can you tell our listeners a little bit before we close how they can contact you and learn more about you and your work?
Oh, you bet. They can just go to my website, harriet@empoweredme.ca, and just get a hold of me there directly, or even give me a call there. Everything is on my website, harriet@empoweredme.ca. And if they want to buy the book, it's also already on Amazon. That's The Secrets to Living a Fantastic Life on Amazon. And it is Dr. Alan Leica and Harriet Tinker. And they can also get a hold of either me or Dr. Leica on their website, alanleica.com.
And how do you spell Liker? L-I-K-E-R? Is that right?
L-Y-C-K-A.
L-Y-C-K-A. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Liker, yeah.
So, Empowered Me, empowerredme.ca is Harriet's website. And, oh my gosh, it's so great to meet you. And I think that, you know, that you're doing so much good. And it's sort of the irony that all the goodness and beauty that is manifesting was further brought to fruition because of the terrible trauma that you went through. But thank God that you survived and that you encountered and grew from the trauma that you experienced, Harriet, in the way that you did, that you're now out there helping other people who have also been wounded and helping them to heal and flower in their own ways. Thank you so much for the beautiful work that you do for people, and thank you for being on our show. Really, really a privilege.
Oh, thank you for having me and having me share my message with the world, because without a platform like yours, my message is nothing. So thank you, and thank you for what you do as well, because you do a lot of great things. Yeah, I don't want to discredit you at all, because you do so much, and I'm so happy to listen to all your podcasts, and I'll continue to do that. So thank you as well.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Well, you're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Stay tuned. I'm going to come back for just a closing message to you after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. Dr. Michael McGee, your host, and you can learn more about me and my work which focuses on healing and growth and transformation at my website, howtolove.com. Well, I just feel moved by our interview with Harriet and her work. What a phenomenon she is, and what an extraordinary human being. So appreciative of her. And I wanted to just sort of, she's inspired me to sort of talk about one of the pearls that she mentioned in her work, the pearl of attitude. Now, I really see the process of becoming a more loving person and developing love in our life as the result of three practices. One is attending to or looking very closely at our experience and cultivating mindful presence, because out of that experience of awareness of this moment, the essence of that bare awareness is really love and compassion. That's just the nature of things, that it is that way. But the second practice that we have control over, including to just attending, paying attention to this moment, to what's arising, the second thing that we have control over is our attitude that Harriet mentioned. And, of course, the third thing that we have some control over is our actions. So our attention, our attitude, and our actions. And really, it's in cultivating those three that we cultivate a loving life. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the attitude of appreciation, which I think is the foundation of the experience of unconditional reverence for ourselves and for others and for existence. that really inspires us to lead lives of love. This attitude of appreciation is very, very, very central. And really, appreciation arises spontaneously out of attending. When you pay very close attention to this moment, you kind of see the obvious that's been there right in front of you all the time. Yeah, that usually we take for granted. And ultimately, it's just the reality of our existence, which is just amazing that we even exist. If you look closely, you can see that we are really the universe just aware of itself, and that we are blessed with the experience of conscious awareness. And I think appreciation is rooted in that kind of basic seeing. It seems like our brains were designed by nature just to sort of take things for granted. That's called habituation. And I really see part of our spiritual practice is learning to just see the truth of things freshly without being clouded by what's this fancy word, habituation, or just sort of this disease of taking things for granted, if you will. But seeing things really, truly as they are, as amazing and miraculous. Existence, this moment is just amazing and miraculous. So that experience of awe and wonder is really so important to cultivate by seeing things freshly as they are. I think the other thing that Harriet mentioned, which I just want to emphasize as well, is the issue of judgment. Our brains do a lot of judging. She talked about this as complaining. But I think complaining is a form of judgment. But we judge ourselves, we judge others, we judge the way things are, and this attitude of judgment is a attitude of non-appreciation of just that things are as they are, and they may be painful, and there may be unskillful, there may be things that are destructive or difficult or uncomfortable. But what is, and when we complain or when we judge, the essence of how things are, the ultimate nature of things in this moment, it really is like picking a fight with reality or God or the sacred or whatever you want to call it. So what I in my practice with people in my personal life and in my work with patients, What I really emphasize and support is cultivating an attitude of unconditional reverence for this moment exactly as it is, even if it's painful, even if it's dysfunctional. But the attitude of almost like a mantra of this moment is sacred, this moment is sacred. And to do so, I think, is kind of an act of humility. It's like saying, this reality as it is constructed and as I'm experiencing it, it is really so much greater than myself, and I'm not the center of the universe. This is how things are, and so it's kind of a spiritual attitude of reverence. And what it does, I think, is when you have that kind of attitude of reverence for things exactly as they are, and are humbly kind of appreciating that things are as they are, I think that brings you into kind of a harmonious relationship with reality. And what it does is it detoxifies this judgment or as Harriet mentioned, complaining. I think judgment really is kind of an act of violence against ourselves, against others. And when we judge in these ways, it really causes so much suffering. I think judgment is at the root of a lot of the violence that goes on, both psychologically but also physically, with each other. And it's so different from discernment, whereas in discernment you're seeing clearly whether something is helpful or harmful or wholesome or unwholesome or painful or not. That kind of discernment without judgment is this attitude of appreciation. So I really encourage you to really reflect on a practice of humbly, reverently appreciating everything exactly as it is, and letting judgments go and not holding on to them, but instead seeing how unwholesome and harmful judgments are, and replacing judgment with discernment instead. And out of discernment, seeing sort of the third day of awakening to love, which is acting with love, in discernment we can ask the question, well, what would love do in this situation? What would love do? And if you have an attitude of appreciation, then you're going to not be acting out of negativity and hatred. You're not going to be acting out of sort of a need to destroy something, but maybe out of an act, out of an intention to help or to build or to restore or to heal, or maybe to create something better than what we have now. I think when you're motivated by love rather than hatred, you just get a better outcome in the long run, and that goes towards addressing your own difficulties or lack of skill. Your own pain, your own challenges. It also goes to helping other people to become more skillful in their lives. If you come at them with an attitude of appreciation that's non-judgmental, but instead is maybe discerning what somebody might need to help them to lead a better life or to feel better or to do better, it's just so much different and so much more helpful when you do it in that way. So I really encourage you to cultivate this attitude of unconditional, reverent appreciation for this moment exactly as it is. And that includes for your pain. Pain is a big one. We're kind of programmed to seek out pleasure and to avoid pain. And it really is that negative judgment of pain causes the most suffering in the world, the avoidance of pain. It leads to increased depression, anxiety, addiction, isolation. There's no way to really resolve pain if you're judging pain as bad and then avoiding pain. So that's really, really important, is to really honor pain as part of the essential nature and reality of things, and not to judge pain as negatively, as something negative or bad, but just as pain, and in that way be able to embrace and work through your pain, including the pain of trauma. It's really through that process of appreciating pain, not judging it, and valuing the essentiality of pain, that we are then able to then embrace and work through our pain, oftentimes and usually with the help of others. Okay, well, we're at the close of our hour today. Really hope this has been beneficial to you, and really want to wish you a week of love and light in your life. If you have any comments or would like to get in touch with me, you can reach me at mdm@wellmind.com, and would love to hear from you. Until next week, take care.